Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, saving our collective retirements from the scammers and from ourselves. New simple ways to invest and draw on our pensions are to be offered to savers as pandemic pension fraud reaches an industrial scale. Tanya lays out what you can do to protect your future. Also, you'd be mad to book a holiday abroad this year. So surely anyone who is brave enough could bag themselves a real bargain. Think again, says Simon. Are we about to see a burst of big ticket inflation and 1, 2, 3 cuts to Santander's popular current account in a year? Is it still worth it? Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, changes are being made to the way that we access our pension pots, basically to stop us messing it up. Pension firms will soon be offering the over 55s 4 simple, ready-made investment deals for when they first dip into their retirement fund if they aren't paying for financial advice first. Now, regulators have ordered that providers take these measures, which will be launched on the 1st of February, because they're worried that inexperienced investors are making poor decisions. Tanya, what's happening?
Well, the regulators are worried about what people are doing with their pension pots. Pension freedoms obviously gave people a lot of control over what they do. But most people who save for retirement through a work pension just simply go in the default fund. The rule of thumb is it's 90% of us do that. And they don't make any investment decisions. They're not used to it. Unless they are used to investing, they are literally from a standing start from age 55, making a whole host of important decisions with a significant amount of money, which they've had absolutely no background before in dealing with. And the regulators have been monitoring this ever since the pension freedoms were launched in 2015. And it came up with some worrying findings. And it's given a lot of thought to this. I mean, the 4 ready-made deals are quite basic in a lot of ways. They're for very, very broad scenarios. And there is understandable argument that they're one size fits all, which means they're not really going to, you know, fit exactly many people. And you are better off doing something that suits you personally. But I think that after weighing up what people were actually doing and researching what people were actually doing with their money, they decided that there was a greater risk of not doing anything, and at least if people were put in some kind of pushed in some kind of basic direction, then the risk of harm would be lessened. The most common error was actually going into pension drawdown, which means investing your pension for retirement, taking the 25% cash-free lump sum and doing it just to get your hands on that, and then putting the rest in a cash fund because you think that's the safe thing to do. They actually put a figure on it, the FCA. They said you can do 37% better with your money, you know, over the course of your retirement if you have a sort of sensible mix of investments, which means investing in shares and bonds and property and so on. So that's the conclusion they came to. We'll have to see once it launches whether it actually works. But I think it puts at least a floor under things, because people will at the very least be going into one of these ready-made funds, which will, you know, give them some level of security. But it's not necessarily an ideal situation either.
Simon, what do you make of this?
I think the really important bit here, as Tanya said, is the fact that the pension freedom revolution that took place some time ago now, we still talk about it as if it happened relatively recently, but it's quite a few years into the past, has been very popular. Now, but the problem is if you ask people what they want in retirement, they say that they like a steady income and they'd like to know what they're going to get. And the thing that provides something like that is actually an annuity. But people don't like annuities because they consider annuities to be very poor value. People weren't encouraged to shop around properly. Interest rates crashing dragged down annuity rates to the floor. And people will for a £100,000 pension pot, you would get a fraction of what you would have got 20 years ago, for example. And there isn't the flexibility. It dies with you. Now, it's an insurance policy, effectively. And if you live a long time, you'll do quite well out of it. And if you live a short time, you won't do well out of it. That's pretty much the same with any insurance policy. If you pay out for car insurance for 30 years, and you never crash your car, you've actually lost on the car insurance. You've won on the not crashing the car thing, but you've lost on the car insurance thing. If you are extremely unlucky and you crash your car once every 10 years, then probably the car insurance is worth it. And if you're really unlucky and you crash a car every 2 years, then you definitely are the kind of person who needs car insurance. There's a similar thing with the annuity thing going on. You know, if you live for a very long time, you're very lucky. And you'll also get the most out of your annuity. So it works slightly the other way around. If you die early, then you're very unlucky and you lose out on the annuity. So you can see why people don't like them. And also that pot dies with you. It doesn't get passed on to your descendants. So people have seized pension freedom with both hands and said, yeah, this sounds much better. But a lot of people who do retire don't really have that much experience of investing. They've not really necessarily engaged that much with investing. If you're a hobbyist investor, if you enjoy investing, if you like picking shares and funds, if you're someone like me who's genuinely interested in it, then this is great. Gives you the opportunity to manage your portfolio in retirement. Arguably, you probably actually do worse than if you just picked a simple tracker fund or actually did pay for a financial advisor. But at least you're engaged and you can own your own mistakes and things like that. But if you've just been in the default company pension fund and all you've just done is put your money in every month and you're not really that fussed about it and you don't know where it goes, you think you know how much you put in, you think you know how much the company puts in. Occasionally you look at your statement and it's going up. Occasionally you look at it's going down and you think, oh no, but then it goes back up again. You get to retirement, what do you do? Well, the problem is, ideally you take financial advice and you get a financial advisor to sort it out for you. But most people don't want to pay for a financial advisor. They consider them to be too expensive, because actually when an advisor charges you thousands of pounds, that might represent a sizable chunk of the pension pot that you've got, because most people don't have particularly big pension pots. It also sounds like a lot of money. And also the advisor will say, well, I've got to put all this time into it. But then when you work it out, they're being paid quite a lot of money for what feels like not a lot of time. And it's very difficult to convince people that somebody else's time is worth a magnitude of theirs. And so they don't take financial advice. But then what do they do? And people are not necessarily worried about choosing the best possible investments. They're really worried about choosing the worst ones, the ones that they'll lose out on. And so you get a lot of people rushing to the safety of cash, or being too cautious, or just going for what they know, and what they know becomes, you know, too concentrated. We have this problem of home bias in investing, things like that. So if you take something like this, this is actually a really good idea, because it says, these are four things, fit yourself into the box. And you know what? This thing might not be the best thing ever, but it will be good. It will be of a certain quality. And it's easy to be cynical with some of this stuff, because, for example, some of the companies offering this are going to be offering their own in-house funds. Okay.
Well, I was going to ask how this is going to technically.
Tanya can explain a bit more about this. But just because they're offering their own in-house funds doesn't mean that you should be cynical, because there is a lot of consideration that has gone into what they're choosing and what they're putting in there. And they know, if you're using a trusted company, they know that people are watching them on this one. Okay. So I think you can have quite a lot of faith in what they're going to choose to put in there.
Tanya, then, the technicals.
Yeah, I think the FCA will be monitoring what these ready-made deals are actually made up of. And I've written a feature about it this week, and a couple of the well-known brokers have revealed to us what they what they're actually putting in, and it is quite interesting. One of them, for the people who say, I just want to put my money in drawdown and not touch it for the next 5 years, their option for that is the Vanguard Life Strategy 60% in Equities fund, which, as they point out, is very popular with their existing customers, and so they've used that one for it. So I think Simon's right. These companies who put these ready-made deals together would have put some careful thought into what they're doing. The regulator has not put a charges cap on. I think it did seriously consider it. It said that they should question themselves, challenge themselves on what charges they're putting on these ready-made deals, with an eye to the 0.75% cap, which is on default pension funds, the ones that you have in the sort of build up to retirement. So that's another consideration as well. But they're going to review it in a year's time, and they say they'll look at charges again. So from that point of view, not just the quality of it, but it's quite likely that firms won't be trying to for charge because they know the FCA is going to be breathing down their neck in a year's time.
Forgive me, Tanya, you don't have to do this, do you?
No, absolutely, absolutely not. There's no obligation on you to take any of these. And there are other prepackaged deals out there that might be a little bit more sophisticated, that might have more investments in them, say, you know, not just one fund, but several funds, a sort of a drawdown portfolio, which is tailor-made for a certain scenario, but it doesn't involve you working out from scratch yourself what investments that you want, which is a tall order for someone who's never invested before to sort of, I mean, there's thousands of funds out there, you know, pick five, pick 10, whatever. That's a big ask of people, some of whom will, sort of, I suppose, discover that they really love it and really enjoy it, but not all. I just wanted to quickly go back to what Simon was saying about financial advisors. The only way you get offered these deals is if you haven't taken financial advice. And I think the major reason that the FCA has done this is because people like Simon says just do not want to get financial advice whatsoever. If you get financial advice, you won't be offered these deals. I've done a lot about financial advice, and there are ways to play it a bit clever with financial advisors. You might be willing to pay a few thousand quid to a financial advisor at the outset, but not want to get involved in an ongoing deal where you're paying a percentage of your portfolio year after year after year. That really puts people off, I think. So if you are going to get a financial advisor, I think it's worth ringing around and saying, will you do this on a one-off basis? And then I'll look after it afterwards. Set me up. And then I'll look after it. And a halfway house would be to, you need a lot of discipline to do this, but say every 3 or 5 years, I'm going to get a financial advisor somewhere to have another look, to review my situation. You'll get a fresh pair of eyes on it. You'll stay on the straight and narrow. They'll tell you what rules have changed and what you need to do with tax in the new scenario down the line. And I think that might persuade some people, that approach might persuade some people who wouldn't normally do advice to take it. You obviously have to find a financial advisor that will go along with it, but I think that might be the way forward for some people who are skeptical about financial advice.
All right then, if we aren't, Tanya, a risk enough to our own retirement, scammers, it appears, are taking it to another level. The coronavirus pandemic has proved to be a catalyst for the unscrupulous to bombard pension savers and investors with fraudulent online ads on an industrial scale. They're not my words, but those of financial regulators who want more money and resources to step up public warning campaigns. An industrial scale, Tanya. What's going on?
I think that this is partly a pandemic thing. They're worried about people who are locked down, who might have lost their job, being on the internet, and they're seeing an absolute flood of fraudulent ads all over the internet. I don't think we want to name any particular sites. I think that anybody who just sort of goes online and uses any search engine would, you know, might stumble across them. And the real threat at the moment, it's really been going up this year, is clone scams. So they're pretending to be legitimate companies. And this is a really dangerous thing because they go to great lengths to look like they are a real company that you've heard of. And because they are really trying to make themselves as like that company as possible, even going to the extent we hear of going to real people's LinkedIn profiles, people in the, you know, in the finance industry, their LinkedIn profiles, and then pretending to be that person based on what they can find out from them. So when you're up against all that, a clone scam is really worrying. And if you go with a scammer that's you know, pretending to be legitimate and then isn't, you might not find out for a while. Unfortunately, it's a lagging problem because you sign up with a scammer, pay over your money, and you might not find out for, you know, 3 to 6 months when you're expecting some interest or you're expecting some engagement that they've actually gone off with all your money.
Simon, is enough being done to prevent this sort of thing happening? I mean, presumably not. That's why the financial regulators want more money and resources.
It's a bit of a game of whack-a-mole, to be honest. I have a degree of sympathy with the FCA and the financial regulators, because you hit one and then another one pops up. I think that there is some responsibility to be taken by the large tech companies that effectively run ad exchanges. Google definitely has a responsibility here. Facebook has a responsibility here through all of the platforms that it owns. Instagram. I mean, someone requested to follow me the other day. He looks like he lives an amazing lifestyle. It's cars, it's yachts. There's a wonderful photo of the guy sitting there at a table by, over a harbour. Looks like somewhere like Monaco or something. It's gorgeous. There's the scantily clad lady, you know, with a very sort of small handbag type dog kind of thing going on. And his thing is money flipping. Money flipping, but we did actually talk about this on a podcast some years ago, it is effectively where basically you sign up to a pyramid and you put some money in, and then you sign up four people below you or something, and then they give you some money, and then they sign up some people below them, and they give them some money, but then they also give you some money, and so on. I mean, it's literally a pyramid scheme. Like, the way it's explained is a pyramid. But, you know, these people are out there doing it. And that's not the same as these pension scams, but these are the scams that are getting people at the other end of the scale, the young people. Same with the money mule stuff, you know. Just have some money paid into your bank account, and then, like, you leave it there, and then you pay it back out to these people. You can have a grand. Totally fine. It's legit. Don't you worry. If you're a student, someone offers you 500 quid or a grand, you're like, well, that doesn't sound illegal. Just having some money paid into my bank account and then paying it back out. That's fine. But that's facilitating the scams that we're talking about here. The scams where people are being scammed into push payment fraud, where basically someone phones up, pretends to be a bank or something, says there's an emergency or something. Or someone phones up and pretends to be an investment advisor. Or someone hacks into the emails of your solicitor so that you send the money to the wrong place. All of this stuff is interconnected. And a lot of it is due to the fact that basically once upon a time, if you wanted to con someone, well, you had to either, you know, pay to take out some advertising, some display advertising somewhere. Like maybe you could do it in the back of the local paper or something, which is a few less checks and balances and a bit cheaper. But there's quite a lot of hoops to jump through. Or you had to go door to door, or you had to meet people. Now you just stick some ads up on the internet. Buy some ads on a social media platform. Buy some ads with Google. And it's hard. I mean, it's hard for Google, Facebook, etc. to crack down on all these. They can't vet every single ad that goes through them because there's so many ads that go through them. But that's how it's happening. And so I do have some sympathy with the FCA when it comes to hitting them. But then the other thing I would say about the FCA is that I think that they act a little bit behind the curve sometimes on things. They're reactive rather than proactive. They've tried to become more proactive in recent years, but we've seen lots of things over recent years, and we've talked about this on podcasts past, where, you know, we've seen adverts for stuff on the tube that it's not a scam, but it's very misleading, it's sort of encouraging people to think that it's savings and interest when actually it's high risk investment. You know, we contact the FCA and say, well, what about this advert for this company on the tube? Well, we don't comment on individual companies' adverts, is what they've said in the past. I mean, really? I think actually maybe you should. And also, I don't think the register is that user-friendly. People are told to look up whether a company's FCA regulated. When you look up whether a company's FCA regulated, it's not really that easy to work out whether they are. I mean, they show up or they don't show up, but it's not that simple to understand because there's companies that use different names. They mimic names, as Tanya said. And then it's not really that easy to understand what they're actually regulated for. It's not the most user-friendly of databases, the old FCA. Register. They do have a Scam Smart page, which is quite useful and helps people look stuff up. But just be cautious, because people always think that it won't happen to them. It only happens to other people, and that's not true, because, you know, it happens, and it happens to everyone, and everyone can be convinced of this kind of stuff. And people can be parted with a very large sum of money by stuff that sounds totally legit and then turns out not to be down the line.
So Tanya, as the pensions and investment editor, you must have read some horrible cases about
people
defrauded from their money. And I'm wondering if it's particularly bad in coronavirus because more people are online. Is that it, or are more people worried? Why now?
Well, yes, I suppose more people are at home online, browsing the internet, and also you know, have lost their jobs or are short of money, or because they're helping out their family members who've lost their jobs. It's a slightly different scam, but we have had a steady stream into our pensions columnist Steve Webb of people wanting to tap their pensions before they're 55, and legitimate companies just won't let you do that because the tax penalty is absolutely huge. I mean, unless is except in very, very a small number of exceptional circumstances, such as you're terminally ill, you will be whacked with a huge tax bill. But unfortunately, those kind of people, the ones that are writing in, they say that they're in debt, they need to access their pension, they're 38, they're 44, and the risk is that they lose their entire pension pot to a scammer, because no legitimate companies would help them do this, only scammers. And then when their money is gone, the tax man will still come up to after them for up to 55% of the money that is already gone. That's a really cruel scam, and you end up in a much, much worse position. Anybody who writes into Steve Webb's column gets a very stiff warning from me about this, and a link to a column by Steve about this. But that, I suppose, indicates the kind of people that might be open, you know, on the internet to falling, you know, for a scam.
When you're desperate, you do most things, wouldn't you?
Yes.
What would you like to see happen then, Tanya, I suppose? I mean, Simon, they're saying it's very difficult for things like Google and Facebook and Instagram to control it. The FCA, best will in the world, behind the curve a little bit. Is it all down to education and promoting these sort of campaigns for public awareness?
Well, the FCA has probably got a point in that they do need to step up their campaign, and they've pointed out that I think it was in Australia they did a real, what they call a saturation coverage campaign. And you can imagine if in every ad break in prime time there was an ad popping up warning about this, you know, for the next month, then people probably would get the point. I also, like Simon says, think the tech companies need to take another look at what they're doing. And also I think, frankly, the government needs to look at what it's doing. It's published an online harms bill. There was quite a lot of lobbying by the finance industry to include financial scams in it, these kind of investment clone scams, say, in it, and get it tackled that way. Reading between the lines, I suspect they've had assurances behind the scenes that although they didn't end up in the online harms bill, the government is taking it seriously, they will do something else, they will do something. But what and when? It's difficult without greater regulation of what ads people are seeing. The suspicion is that this is organised crime, by the way. I mean, I'm sure there are some individual fraudsters dotted around who are just putting these ads up on the internet. But industrial scale, and those are the FCA's words, that does suggest that this is organised crime. And that is what I'm hearing from industry people that they suspect.
It's even more scary. All right, thank you, Tanya. We'll leave that to one side. And now for hot tubs. Don't turn off. I'm sort of joking. We're going to focus on big ticket inflation, because, Simon, that's what you've been concentrating on this week. But while your main focus was holidays, were hot tubs, and you mentioned this, the canary in the coal mine of what is to come? What got you thinking about this subject, Simon?
Yes, hot tubs were the canary in the coal mine. I absolutely 100% agree. So what got me thinking about this was actually, it goes back all the way to the hot tub stuff last summer. But what got me thinking about this was actually an article that we talked about in one of our meetings the other day. And I said to George Nixon, who's our savings reporter, I said, do you think this lockdown savings thing is going to continue? This phenomenon of the lockdown saver, people saving loads more money because they basically can't spend it, they can't do it. Or do you think that some of that effect has ebbed away? Because the thing is, people will have got used to saving the money that they were saving in the first lockdown, you know, 10 months ago in March. You know, the money that they suddenly started saving from not commuting, not going out, not going on holiday and stuff. You quickly get used to things like that. You quickly absorb them into your budget. And then you also very quickly start to find other ways to spend your money. Obviously, those are extremely limited at the moment, having gone into another lockdown. But you'd be surprised. And also, not everybody's feeling this phenomenon. You're only really feeling this phenomenon if you did used to have a big commute cost. Maybe if you did used to spend a lot on going out or holidays, restaurants, anything like that. If you didn't, then you won't be feeling it. And if you've lost your job, or you got furloughed and lost a load of income, or have been hit in any other way, or your partner's lost their job, then you won't feel it either. I mean, in all honesty, I don't feel like much of a lockdown saver, because until very shortly before the first lockdown, I was living in London and I cycled to work every day, pretty much 5 days a week, every working week of the year, and had done for 14 years. So my commute costs were very, very small. So I never got that few hundred pounds a month benefit that a lot of people felt. I've certainly felt it on holidays. But then I did manage to do a bit of stuff. You know, we went away for a week in the UK last year, which is not a money-saving endeavour into the school holidays. And we did manage to escape to Portugal for a week as well, in the brief window that you could do that. So I saved a reasonable amount on holidays. Definitely saved money on going out and things. Restaurants, I guess a lot of my money would go out on eating out for dinner. Just family stuff, but paying for a family of four to eat dinner is always expensive. But also, my wife's self-employed and hasn't had any help from the government, so our household income has dropped considerably. So I don't feel like a lockdown saver, but I know friends and family who do, who've said to me, yeah, I'm saving so much more money than I used to. So people have built up, some people, but a sizable number of people, enough for the Bank of England to have commented on it and various other official bodies, have built up these sizable pots of lockdown savings. And Andrew Hagger, when asked about this by George Nixon, said he thought the lockdown saving thing would continue, and said, I doubt anybody is mad enough to be booking a holiday just yet. A comment that piqued my interest in two ways. One, in the sense that how far we've moved on in less than a year, that booking a holiday is seen as an outlandish exercise, something weird for someone to do. That's very strange, that shift in the national psyche. And secondly, the fact that yours truly had actually been eyeing up holidays. Hopeless addict that I am. Before we started recording, I was complaining to Georgie and Tanya that I should be in Austria right now. I should have flown last night. Long weekend snowboarding. Me and my wife always go in January without the kids, stay in a nice hotel, spend the weekend snowboarding, eating good food, drinking good wine, having a thoroughly nice time. Voice. I know. And you can't go at the moment. The lifts are open in Austria, but only for locals, only for Austrians. You're not allowed to stay in hotels overnight. So it's not a lockdown. It's not a you can't leave the country. It's not a nobody wants to let the British in at the moment. All of which things are true. It is technically illegal to go on holiday at the moment. I did... say to you guys and showed you the picture on Instagram, didn't I, of the resort in the Arlberg that we often go to that I'm following, and I was like, I need to stop doing this because it's snowing loads. There's just so much snow. I looked at there was a picture of the hotel that we normally stay in yesterday. It was just like covered in snow. I sent it to a friend of mine. He's like, yeah, but it would have been empty anyway. I was like, yeah, I mean, you're not actually allowed to stay there. So basically, mm-hmm. I'm complaining about not being allowed to go and like relive a long weekend in The Shining. but anyway, I digress. Hopeless addict that I am, I was eyeing up flights to go away at Easter to go skiing and snowboarding with the family. I'm hoping that, you know, there's might be a sliver of opportunity for that. I'm hoping I'm not going to have to scrap it 2 years in a row. They ain't cheap, and there's not a lot of them. You'd think at a time when nobody's booking flights that flights would be cheap and plentiful, but they are not. The airlines hacked back their schedules in the last lockdown. They then bumped them up again when you could leave the country again. They then started, when it started to go sour again, in autumn time, they hacked them. And then when the lockdown hit in November, they took them back more. Tier four, again, more. Now, hardly any on. Now, they could put more on. But they know that if you suddenly get allowed to leave the country and people can go away, people like me, stupid people like me, are going to want to go. COVID compliant, of course, are going to want to go. And they can squeeze them on the price of the flights, even if they do put more flights on. And it's not that easy to just suddenly click and get a load more flights on. They can do it relatively easy, but it's not that easy. So it's going to be expensive. I have basically resigned myself to the fact that if we do go, I'm going to end up paying through the nose for it. But this is true of a lot of things, I think. And I think we're going to see a bout of big ticket inflation, because we saw, to go back to that canary in the coal mine thing, we saw this happen last year. People were very eager to spend money when they could, and there was stuff that they couldn't get their hands on, and the price of it went up, or it sold out. Hot tubs. Couldn't buy a hot tub for love nor money last summer. There was a hot tub boom. Who would have thought it? In the middle of the greatest recession the country had seen since the great frost recession of, what is it, 1709 or something like that, Britain goes mad for spending hundreds or thousands of pounds on hot tubs. Couldn't get your hands on them. But similar, holiday lets, staycations. You couldn't rent a decent place to stay for a reasonable price in this country after about the end, like mid-July last year. Everywhere was completely booked up and people were paying big money to stay places. Similarly true with some other items, expensive garden furniture, fire pits. It was really difficult to get tables in restaurants and good pubs, like popular places, when you were allowed to go to them. And there was talk that people were going to actually end up seeing quite a bit of extra price hikes in popular restaurants and fancy restaurants because they couldn't fit as many people in, and there was the demand to go there, and their costs were higher, and they were going to have to put up the prices. And I think that once we, this time around, it's going to be slightly different because, you know, we've got the vaccines behind us. We've hopefully going to put the lockdowns behind us. There's going to be a surge of people wanting to spend money and get out and enjoy themselves. 2020 has taught them to seize the moment to do stuff. When it comes, seize the moment and do stuff, because the moment might be taken away from you again. I think a lot of people are taking that mentality. And the simple laws of supply and demand tell you that if there's plenty of demand and there's not so much supply of this stuff, they're going to put the squeeze on prices. So inflation is currently very low. The most recent inflation figure is 0.3%. But inflation is not, you know, that's just the basket of goods. There's very different levels of inflation. Older people suffer different inflation. Younger people suffer different inflation. People in different chunks of society, people with different lifestyles. But you suffer different inflation on the stuff that you spend on. There's your everyday spending. There's your discretionary spending, the stuff that you don't need to spend on, but you do spend on regularly, the restaurant meals, the pubs, the stuff like that. And then there's the big ticket stuff. And I think we're going to, unfortunately, just as we get the opportunity to splash out on this big ticket stuff, see a burst of big ticket inflation. And there are some things that people are still struggling to get their hands on, and that are quite expensive. Building supplies, home improvement stuff, electric cars, laptops. It's quite difficult to get your hand on a decent laptop at the moment as well. So
that doesn't surprise me if everybody's working from home. Simon, I do remember, though, a conversation with you, maybe sort of 6 months, and we were sort of mooting the idea that there might be a stack 'em high, sell 'em cheap approach. No longer do you think that that could be a possibility?
This was the Ryanair sort of approach to it. Maybe. I think if you're Ryanair or you're EasyJet or BA, you're pretty cute with these things, and you know, you can see where the demand's coming from. And Ryanair, that was people being scared to fly, and worried there was going to be restrictions. And that was when the quarantine roulette thing was going on, and people were like, well, if I book and then like they change it and I have to quarantine for 2 weeks, I can't really do that. So Ryanair were doing the pile them high, sell them cheap thing. You know, if the vaccines roll out as we hope, and things get lifted as we hope, and restrictions aren't just going to suddenly magically ease, we're going to be living with this stuff for a long time. There are still going to be restrictions. You know, I think that maybe they're going to be a bit cuter with it. And we had a story yesterday, massive surge in over 50s holiday bookings. The travel industry claiming it's seeing a vaccine confidence effect. TUI said that more than 50% of the bookings on its website in the last couple of weeks were from those over 50, and that they've gone up a lot, and that also they're booking fortnights away rather than a week. And there was also other comments from the travel industry saying people were splashing out on, you know, big family holidays. So not just your immediate family, but the grandparents and everyone as well, big villas and stuff like that. Again, big ticket stuff. And what happens when there's loads of people trying to buy stuff and there's a limited supply of it? The people selling it go, make a little bit of extra money here.
Of course. Tanya, we did have actually the Transport Secretary, though, saying a slight warning against booking for summer holidays away this year. So it sort of shows that, well, a cautious approach is probably quite a wise one. Your thoughts?
Well, it is a risk, isn't it, booking a holiday at the moment? I haven't been browsing the sites or even contemplating it, but I understand the temptation. I mean, I think everyone will party really, really hard when this is over. People will be out 7 nights a week, I think, partying like crazy. I think that inflation, it will be quite lumpy, in that some things will be affected by the supply and demand thing that Simon has described, and other things won't. And in some areas that we might, you know, the supply will be, you know, ramped up so quickly by companies desperate to, you know, make some money again, that actually it'll be absolutely fine. But then in certain sort of unexpected areas, I mean, there will be certainly manufacturing, you know, things have been mothballed, people have been furloughed. How quickly can they get certain things online again to make components we've never heard of for things that we really are suddenly going to want to buy like crazy? So it'll probably pop up in it. Unexpected places, although we all do have our own personal inflation rate, as Simon says, the headline inflation rate is important to people who keep an eye on it. And when inflation gets really bad, it's when inflation expectations set in. People start saying, oh, things are going up, and then they start really worrying about it, and it becomes more of a long-term issue. So it is definitely still worth keeping an eye on the headline. Right.
All right, finally, Santander's popular 123 current account got its third cut in a year. Customers will earn just 0.3% interest, down from 0.6% currently, and from 1.5% this time last year, although the bank has not made any cuts to the cashback that it pays customers at this time. And to be fair, the fee has been cut from £5 to £4. Is that fair, Simon?
Is it fair?
Well, I said, to be fair, considering they've cut the interest rate by 50%, you'd imagine they would perhaps cut the fee a little bit more. But look, is it worth it?
Was it all's fair in love, war, and interest rate cuts?
Exactly.
Something like that, isn't it? I mean, at least it's got a three in it. It's the 123 account, and it was a bit confusing that it was the 0.6, and now it's back to a 3. I mean, it's 0.3, not 3.
No.
But, you know, it's a 3.
It's the magic.
As someone once said, 3 is the magic number. 0.3 is the magic number, yes. I mean, it's not really that surprising, is it? You only need to take a quick Scooby down the old interest rate tables of the best savings rates to discover that a cut down to 0.3% was probably on the cards. It's disappointing because you are limited on the amount of money that you can earn that 0.3% on. But the amount of money that you can earn that 0.3% on is £20,000. It's not a £1,500 limit like, you know, some accounts are. And they've cut the fee. I mean, at least they've cut the fee, you know, from £5 to £4 to coincide with the latest changes. And actually, in theory, depending on how much money you've got in there, you might do better off the cut in the fee than you lose on the cut in the interest rate, if you understand what I mean. There is a sort of breaking point kind of thing. I don't know exactly what that breaking point is, and I can't do the maths really, really quickly whilst talking to you on this podcast. But it just goes to show that it's really not worth it anymore in terms of some of these interest paying current accounts. What was once an absolutely fabulous deal is not so fabulous anymore, but it's only beaten by 8 easy access savings accounts in our best buy tables, which pay up to 0.5%. So I mean, only 8 savings accounts beat it. There's a lot of other savings accounts below it, so maybe it isn't that bad, and at least you're earning something on the money that you leave sitting in your current account. Because the great thing about interest paying current accounts is that people tend to leave quite a lot of money sat in their current account, and it basically earns no interest and gets eroded by inflation. And anything that you are earning is a better than nothing, and it will help you try to keep up with inflation a little bit more. This actually matches the most recent inflation rate. But really, it's not the inflation rate of the past that you need to worry about here. It's the inflation rate of the future. And it's probably likely that inflation is going above 0.3% over the next year. Not that high, but it's going above it. But at least you're getting something. The question I think for people is if it's not their rainy day savings, if it's not the money that they've got set aside for when their car breaks or the boiler goes kaput or just in case they lose their job or whatever, is what are they doing with all the cash they've got? Do they need to have all of that money in cash? Could they do something else with it? You can get a better return than this, for example, simply in the premium bonds. And that's pretty much as good as cash because you can take that straight back out. But do you think about investing it? But then how do you invest it? And people are like, whoa, hang on a minute. Because if the stock market, you know, falls by 10% this year, which people are saying shares are going to rise, they're going to rebound, they're going to bounce really strongly once we get the kind of vaccine in and, you know, we start shifting away from the misery of 2020 to the roaring 20s that we're going to see. Stock market, the US stock market is riding super, super high. And there are concerns over this stuff, you know, that we could be in the final melt up, that we're seeing the kind of exuberant behavior, Tesla shares, Bitcoin, big tech, all that kind of stuff, that you see at the tail end of a bubble and that the bubble is going to burst. I would highly recommend anybody listening to this podcast who invests, Googling Jeremy Grantham, The Last Dance. Okay. He's a very famous investor, and he put out an investment note last week. The Last Dance refers to back to before the credit crunch. It was Citibank, Chuck Prince, I think, asked about, you know, whether it was a bubble, and he said, well, you know, while the music's playing, you keep dancing, kind of thing. And Jeremy Grantham is saying you are seeing the exuberant tail end of a bubble. You can't call the end of a bubble, and it can be painful being out of it at the end because you watch this melt up happen, and markets can continue to get more expensive and you're missing out on it. But at some point, you will be glad that you ducked out. Now, I'm not saying that that's necessarily going to happen. I think potentially UK stock markets, not a bad bet for a rebound from coronavirus, the vaccine rally. It's relatively underpriced and things like that. I don't know whether I'd buy Tesla shares, to be perfectly honest. But you do need to be a bit wary of that kind of stuff. So people are understandably cautious about investing the pots of cash they've got. But you can invest in things that take a cautious approach. We literally started this podcast talking about them. Those four pathways that are being put forward for pension savers are, every single one of them is a relatively cautious investment. Even the 60% equity Vanguard one is a relatively cautious investment. But you can go 20% equity of Vanguard. You can invest into an investment trust like Personal Assets Trust, like Ruffer, like RIT. And these are all trusts that have a capital preservation strategy, which the idea is that they first goal is don't lose money. Second goal is try to make people some money. And you're going to look at it and you'll look at some of the share price rises that we've seen this year and you'll think, oh, this trust is rubbish. Scottish Mortgage has doubled its money in the past year. And this trust's only up they're probably actually up about 10%. It's not very good, is it? You know, but again, that's another warning sign. When you start looking at stuff that's only up 7 or 10% and think, well, I haven't made much on that. But, you know, they will protect people much, much more if a crash comes, and you will still be getting, you will still probably be comfortably beating the 0.3% on your Santander account. But you do run the risk that when you go to take that money out, if you want all of it in one go, you might not be able to get all of it in one go. It might be down a bit. But maybe you could afford to not be able to get 5 or 10% of it. You might not be able to afford to not get 70 or 80% of it. You might be able to afford to not get 5 or 10% of it. You might be able to take a bit more risk. But don't do that with your rainy day money. Don't do it with your emergency cash.
Well, on the Santander 123 account, I never got one. And to be honest, all these little rules, the cash back, they've tweaked the rules about that again, apparently. And now it's, what, £4 instead of £5. And it's also fiddly. With current accounts, surely people want something straightforward. I did actually get a new current account at the end of last year for various reasons, and I didn't even consider the Santander thing, basically because I can't be bothered to keep up with all the changes that I'd need to know whether it was worth doing or not. I got a second bank account though, and I think it's probably worth mentioning this because it doesn't come up very often, on the advice of Lee Boyce, who wrote a very interesting opinion piece a few years ago about how it's actually advisable to have a second, two current accounts these days. It's partly because of all the IT meltdowns. I think it was in reference to that that he wrote about it, that it's very handy to have a second one in case that happens to you. But also the money laundering rules. We're getting so many emails from people who suddenly out of the blue get their current account frozen. I had a nice sized check to pay in from a member of my family, and I was worried that if I paid it into my ordinary current account that they might think I was money laundering. And I know that sounds paranoid and outlandish, but we get emails from people who get their accounts frozen all the time and they're never told why. And I just thought, this is the time, you know, Lee told me years ago that I should get a second bank account, and this is the time to do it. But did not consider Santander.
I've never done the second bank account thing. I need to read Lee's piece again because I remember it the first time round. All right then, thank you very much. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions of the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got any problems, if you've got an interesting story that you want to tell us about. Maybe you've tried to buy something expensive and been shocked at how actually expensive it was, or actually just struggled to get your hands on something. Or maybe there's a secret you know to buy the things that everybody wants and get a really good deal on them. Come and tell us. editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us @thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and join in the debate in reader comments and tell me what an absolute plum I am for thinking that I'm going to manage to go snowboarding at Easter.
Yeah. I'm also wondering, are there loads of hot tubs on eBay now as people realise what a stupid thing to buy?
No, but I tell you what, there's loads of people asking questions. I've seen this on like social media. People going, what do you do with your hot tub in winter? It's like the old puppy for Christmas thing, isn't it?
Goodness me. Right, well, if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.